to this point.
Okay, well, right, then.
Good afternoon. Today is Thursday, June 13th. I'd like to open the House Committee on Veteran Service and Emergency Preparedness.
And in that same line, I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness and ask Madam Vice Chair if you'd make a few comments, please.
As usual, I really do like sharing the portraits of women combat veterans. You know, there's been such a transition and a male-oriented culture in the military, and I have no idea if some of these statements make a difference or not. But I'm going to go ahead and share Staff Sergeant Deborah Falk, U.S. Army, her thoughts regarding women versus men in the military. I was asked to work for this first sergeant. I got the impression that he had not had a lot of experience working with females. He seemed to be very domineering. When I would speak up for myself and stand up to him, he did not like it. I went to bat for the soldiers. That's when I would often get myself in trouble. I ended up getting a reduction in my rank. I have it back now, but it got to the point where he escalated this negative relationship with his documentation. And there were other male soldiers who appeared to have the same leadership style. The more I would fight, the harder things would get for me. I was put on extra duty in the hot heat to stack sandbags, long hours during the mid part of the day. But I never did fight it because my goal was to get my rank back. So there were things that happened to me that I'm not necessarily proud of, but not ashamed of either, because it boils down to me standing up for my rights. There were other females, but they sat back and did nothing. At first, I was very angry. When I step back now and look at things in the healing process, I realize that it was survival for them. I have this new duty as an equal opportunity person in the unit I'm assigned to now, and I'm glad to be a part of it because I am a fighter. I am an advocate not only for rights for women, but also for rights for people in general. I think about those women who stood back and did nothing. I would have done differently. I can truly say from my heart that I would have risked a lot more in order to stand up for justice. So I was considered to be a troublemaker. I took EEO training for the other week, and you know, it was just really interesting to see how those advocates are often looked upon as being troublemakers when we stand up for what is right. Yes, you have to have a voice. You have to stand up for what you believe in. You have to pursue. You have to persist. If I give up, what about the people who come behind me, the other females, my grandchildren? And those are the words of Staff Sergeant Deborah Falk. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Obviously, some of our generals need EEO training, too. But with that, Mr. Chair, you can have the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to let everybody know that there's a number of House Committee members. They may be absent. All House Committee members may be required to leave early for the afternoon floor session that was just scheduled earlier today. We also have, I believe, one of the caucus will be meeting at 1:30, so people will be coming in and out. We apologize, but that is how things will roll today. The agenda orders are going to change just slightly. The Oregon Business Development Department has been moved to the end of the agenda. With that, I think everybody's been told about kind of the timeline of which you have to speak, and we would appreciate it. We had a great meeting last week and look forward to another meeting today. Today is, of course, the second of three of these informational meetings, so appreciate your time. And we will start, I believe, with we have Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission. So we'll need just your names again for the record prior to testimony, and you may begin in either order, in whatever order you desire.
Thank you, Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, members of the House and Senate committees. My name is Jay Wilson. I'm an emergency manager with Clackamas County. I'm also the vice chair of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission. Testifying today on Chapter 2 of the Oregon Resilience Plan is Susan Stewart, who represents the building owners for OSPAC, and also Jerry Williams, who's a former OSPAC member. Jerry and Susan both were the primary authors of the Chapter 2 for Business Workforce Continuity. So again, we appreciate your giving us the opportunity to come and testify on these three chapters. We'll get started.
I think as a point of departure, Chairman Boquist and Chairman Matthews, thank you for having us here. As a point of departure, just for our own kind of setting the plate for the chapter.
We'll need your name for the record.
Oh, I'm Jerry Williams.
Thank you.
I'm
so
sorry.
Much.
I thought his introduction was okay. As a point of departure, I think we all recognize that businesses need some fundamental things to survive. You need to have products that, and services that people want to buy. You have to have a place to produce those things. You have to have a system of being able to transmit them. You have to have a capital that can, you can use, get capital to transform and make things. You need to have a government that can enforce contracts. And you need, of course, to have workers and customers. And those are kind of the fundamental things. And so if we take a look at, you know, a fairly simplistic model of of how these things interact, there's a, and this is a fairly simplistic model. Do you have it?
They're getting the projectors up right now.
Okay, this is when they come up or when it comes up. What you'll see is a fairly simplistic model of some major areas of infrastructure and how they interact and how they are interdependent with businesses, public, the workforce, the customers, government, food supply, and all these things. And so ultimately, what we looked at in the course of our writing of this chapter was, you know, how do earthquakes affect businesses? And recognizing that the vast majority of businesses in Oregon are small businesses and that they have to move things from place to place. Most of those have commercial buildings and are in commercial buildings, and a FEMA study recently showed that roughly 27% of buildings will have no damage, but the largest proportion, 83% or 73%, would be damaged in an earthquake. In the Portland metropolitan area, which is where most of our people and most of our economy is centered, that proportion is actually much higher because of the large proportion of unreinforced masonry buildings and other things. Fundamentally, you know, what we know about earthquakes is they break stuff. And once they're broken, we're going to have to fix them. They have long-term and short-term impacts. The short-term impact is we got to directly go out and fix the bridges that don't work or that have fallen down. We have to fix the buildings to the extent that the buildings can be fixed. And we have to fix all of the utilities and infrastructure that delivers everything else, get the banking system back online, get food in for people to be fed. And this creates kind of a long-term indirect impact that we have to deal with, which is how is that, and this is a big part of our report, is that, okay, how are we going to then get people back into businesses and get those businesses back up and running in the long term so that we can, as a state, you know, recover.
We do have your slides, if you can tell us what the slides are.
Yeah, we have your slides on the OLIS website. It's been loaded, so we're just...
We're following.
We're trying to catch up and follow along, and hopefully we can kind of sync ourselves here.
Chair Bogus, Chair Matthews, we've called the technical support so they can come in and fix it.
It's the NSA,
mid-stride.
I can see that.
Currently, we're just finishing slide six and going into slide seven. Jerry was just finishing that portion.
Thank you. Apologize.
That's all right. So, slide eight, or?
This is where you... This is your slide.
Slide nine is where we talk about the scale of these disasters that are great examples for us to look at. If we can take a look at a number of earthquakes that have occurred in the last 10 to 20 years, most recently in Japan, the losses, the direct damage and the indirect damage has represented a huge portion of their gross domestic products for the expenses that are going to have to be incurred to rebuild and recover. And this is one thing that we're talking about for Oregon, is that this damage, although our report had estimated about $30 billion in damage, you know, when you start getting into the indirect costs and the long-term repairs with uncertainties in future economies, it's probably more like $50 billion to $100 billion. And that really adds up almost to an entire year's worth of Oregon's gross domestic product. The expenses for that are out there in losses by not embracing resilience and trying to build this extra capacity into our systems would have a devastating impact on our economies. Looking at Hurricane Katrina, this is one thing that our economist, Bryce Ward, had just said, that it would take almost an entire year worth of services and products for us to be able to cover all of these expenses. And that's a huge economic setback for the state to be dealt such a blow like that. Slide number 11. This is something that was done at a national scale, talking about disaster mitigation. Spending $1 saves $4 in the long term. That's a very generalized estimate. But when we're talking about resiliency, and the cost of building extra capacity into our interdependent systems, this is something that we made a point in our initial briefing, is the cost of a bridge or a school for upgrades or replacement is really small compared to the loss of that capacity in a disaster, for not having that school as a shelter, and then to get kids back in school, or a bridge to function after a disaster. The value of that capacity greatly outweighs the cost of the actual facility or asset. Go ahead, Susan.
My turn. I'm Susan Stewart with BOMA, Oregon, and I'm going to look at yours because our slides are out of order. The majority of buildings in Portland and the state were built prior to the latest seismic code change. We don't know how these buildings will react depending on the type of and the power of the event, but we have to assume that they're probably not going to fare very well. One of our one of our recommendations, and we had a lot of recommendations for you, is to somehow public-private partnership with the state of Oregon to incentivize building owners to upgrade their buildings. I liken it kind of like to the Betsy credits or to the Energy Trust of Oregon. There's got to be some kind of mechanism to help building owners, because right now the only time seismic issues come up is if you hit a trigger, if you upgrade a big portion of your building, if you spend a certain amount. And we need something to help them out, because they cannot afford this on their own. And buildings sell so quickly, especially in Portland, that that most owners won't commit those kind of funds because they're not going to own the building that long. Other things we discussed, a number of states have what are known as BEOCs, Business Emergency Operation Centers. And Oregon has a number of emergency operation centers, but there isn't a public-private partnership. And the private sector has a lot to offer with supplies and employees and anything you can think of. And we're advocating for a public-private partnership where they have a business relationship. I was on Top Off a number of years ago, and every public official is very well prepared. And my question was, well, what about the private sector? And they hadn't thought that far. One other thing we want to talk about, and I hope Jay jumps in, we are recommending that building codes, fire officials walk through buildings with building owners now, before an event. So they're familiar with these buildings, they know where the shutoffs are, they know all the problems with the buildings. So when an event happens, they're not going in blind. And I believe there's a program in San Francisco.
What Susan's referring to in the city of San Francisco, they have a program called the Building Occupancy Resumption Program. It's a very innovative program that's been around for over 10 years, but the city building inspectors will go to a designated building, a business building, a residential building, and review the structure of that building, its design, its age, based on its inherent weaknesses, for its design and age, they can predetermine what they think an earthquake would do to that building. And they'll put a recognition placard on the building that they're participating in this to bring some recognition to the owner. But in the event of an earthquake, the inspectors aren't going to be walking inside that building in the dark without any familiarity of what they're looking at, and it helps to more quickly determine if the building can be safely occupied and to get it back up and running more quickly because they're aware of what the building's issues are in advance. So it's just a measure that can be accomplished well in advance of an earthquake to help expedite reoccupancy of buildings and not have unnecessary dislocation and disruption.
Okay. I have one final comment. Your business can be as prepared as anybody, as all get out. It could be terrific. But if businesses do not encourage and motivate their employees to have their own plans or family plans, they're not coming back to work. So you can get us out of the building, you can get us home, but if I haven't done my due diligence and have my supplies and have my family prepared, I'm not going back to the office. And that's another thing to really think about. We have to, businesses do for business, but they need to take it to employees. And Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, they actually have incentives for their employees when they can show different steps they've taken, financial or freebies, little tchotchkes that they get as they're doing their emergency preparedness for their homes. So it's very important.
I can just say, too, in Clackamas County, for my office in emergency management, we provide orientations to every new employee around their responsibility to be prepared at home so that they can take care of their family, their household, and report to work, either for a day-to-day function that has to be resumed or an emergency function. But it's this whole idea that we all, as employees, also have households and family members that we have responsibilities for, but we need to take steps in advance and take the responsibility for that so that we can, as public employees especially, get back to work and provide the services that people depend on. This whole idea about employee preparedness for the sake of getting back to work is a critical part of this business and workforce continuity piece. Jared, do you have a closing comment?
No.
I'd just like to say, before we open it up, that we want to reiterate the four primary general recommendations that we have in the plan, that first and foremost for things like businesses and business vulnerability, we really need to do more detailed assessments before we start making strategies and investments here. We need to have a real strategy for capital improvements and tying seismic and tsunami preventative measures into day-to-day capital improvements. We need to work on private and nonprofit incentives so that real resilience becomes a market issue and that people see it as a value to invest in. And then also our public policies really need to reflect resilience, especially in building codes and land use and recovery planning. And how does that tie into comprehensive planning as well? So thank you again.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you all for your testimony. Any questions of the panel? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan and Jerry, could you talk just briefly, because when you obviously sat down with all these business groups and headed up this work group on the business side, what sort of discussions was there around business liability? I think, Susan, you made mention of doing inspections, so on and so forth. The problem with that is when you do an inspection and suddenly you realize now there's a problem.
Exactly.
You've now established third-party liability,
right,
tort issues. And what were most of the businesses saying? What type of legislation did they need? What type of top cover did they need?
One of the things we've discussed frequently with building owners, and I represent about 40 million square feet, so a lot of building owners, in addition to the inspections, the discussion about sheltering in place. If my building is terribly damaged and yours isn't, can I come across the street and stay in your building? And overwhelmingly, no building owner is going to accept that liability for someone else's tenants or employees. The other thing we discussed, actually many things we discussed, about you have your chief engineers in the big buildings. Could they be certified as ATC 20 inspectors and help out? Because, you know, you have single owners, multiple owners. You know, could my owner, who owns just his building, go across and help five other buildings? No. You get back to the liability. We know that the state can indemnify ATC 20 inspectors, but that happens. And jump in, Jay, after the event. So it's a huge, huge issue. So when Jay was telling me about the San Francisco program, huge issue about letting someone in your building and possibly publicizing that it's not safe.
You're going to get a presentation following ours in a few minutes about critical buildings and by a couple of engineers that have a lot more experience and understanding about this, and they'll talk, I think, about some of those engineering liability issues.
Just to follow up on what Susan said about liability for inspectors, this is one of the critical reoccupancy issues following an earthquake for getting businesses back in place and getting residents back in their homes. Is the state really needs a much more comprehensive post-earthquake building inspection program, not just a registration list. But at this time, we don't have any real organized method for contacting these people, for doing call downs, for doing immediate deployment, just basically laying the groundwork for how this would work. We just have a registration list that's managed with the Department of Building Codes, and that's it. The state of California has been having a lot of earthquakes, in the past, and so theirs is very well organized. But they have call down lists through professional organizations that get initiated after an earthquake. Architects, engineers are registered through these associations. There's a lot of coordination just to get this thing moving. It's more than just checking a piece of paper when you're looking at a building. It's making all of this a systematic approach for tracking the information, for managing the information. We would be making all of that up on the spot if we had an earthquake right now.
Well, which is why we're here having the meetings, having the discussion now, and trying to dedicate as much time as we can. I appreciate that very much. And thank you all. Is there any further questions from the panel? For the panel? Thank you for being here. Thank you for your testimony. We apologize for the AV situation. Still working through that, but again, we're on OLIS, and some folks have it up on the screen. And I think next for Coastal Communities, Jay, you're going to stay seated, correct? And then Mr. Raskin, if you'll please come forward. And was there anybody else going to join you today, Mr. Wilson?
No, it'll just be Jay Raskin and myself.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
So we have our slides, too. I'm sorry these aren't up for the folks in the room, because we really meant to have some impact with these slides for the sake of the points we're trying to make. I'll go ahead and get started, and Jay can introduce himself. He's got a few slides in the middle that we'll turn to.
Yeah, I'm Jay Raskin, public member of OSPAC, and also worked with Jay Wilson on the Coastal Workshop.
And just so you both know, I'm told by Ms. Ross that we're going to have some hard copies printed out. So we'll have these slides available here shortly in hard copy form. So.
Okay. Thank you. All right. When we were here last time, we've given you an image of a map that's in the plan. It's a multicolored map that represents four zones that are key to understanding this resilience plan for the state. And it's really how far inland will this earthquake affect communities? And we have a central and eastern Oregon zone that's on the other side of the Cascades. We have the I-5 corridor where most of the economy and population lives. And then we have the coast. And the coast has its own distinct chapter in this report for a reason, because they've got the most to lose in terms of lives, and will have the hardest time recovering in terms of isolation. And they have two distinct areas along the coast, and this is probably the single thing we want to impress upon these two committees the most, is interdependencies we've discussed before are for around systems, transportation, energy, fuel. Those are all very codependent, interdependent. But on our coastline, there's an interdependency that exists between high ground and low ground. And this is for every community on the coast. This is a critical aspect of every one of these communities, where they're situated and their unique relationship to the ocean. And that relationship is so significant for their economies, for their sense of place, but it also translates into their inherent vulnerability. So in highlighting the most significant issues, we want to start where we always do. It's about life safety. For over 20 years, we've had a tsunami program in Oregon that has completely focused on getting people to high ground before a tsunami hits. It's for residents, it's for employees, vacationers, and we've done mapping, we've done signage, we've done a lot of education, but
this is all there is. I mean, the program really is about getting people there. It doesn't protect any infrastructure. It doesn't save any land. And as we said once before when we first briefed you, approximately 22,000 people who live in that zone will be permanently displaced within about a half hour after this earthquake because the tsunami will take all of their homes and their communities for the most part. And so these people and the visitors who were there at the time are going to have the greatest need for immediate relief and short-term and long-term housing. The other thing that was addressed in the plan was a 90% restoration in 2 to 4 weeks that we were looking at from Japan and Chile as a target we wanted to have in 50 years. And we had a lot of consideration for this at the coast. We kept it there as a target, but the question really is for the coast, based on how much isolation there is, based on any number of the degree of devastation, is this 90% reasonable? Is it possible? And the real reason is this will suffer the greatest losses and have the greatest challenges for recovery, this interdependency that I spoke about. And then the duality that always will be there for if this happens in the winter versus the summer. What's our ability in the summer with so many visitors on the beach? Cannon Beach is just about to host their sandcastle contest, and that draws so many people as well. But on the other hand, if it's a winter event, exposure to the elements could quickly cause a lot of people to succumb to exposure. Mitigation, recovery, and reconstruction, therefore, have been the primary emphasis in our report and in this chapter. We're really going to focus on land use for coastal communities, because that is one thing they do have control over. They can't control how their power is delivered or the reconstruction of coastal highways, but they do have an ability to control where their business districts are and where residential areas are. And then the return of the economic base after this event happens is another key thing for the viability of coastal economies and also the impact that would have on the state's economy. And lastly, debris management. In Japan, they estimated 22 million tons of debris were generated. And while we don't have as much development on our coastline as they do, debris is still going to be a huge issue in choking our waterways, in having to be cleared before any heavy equipment can get in, and staging and disposing of this material while it competes for land with reclaiming damaged areas and housing emergency staff to stay out there. We want to draw this distinction again between sustainability and disaster resilience. While sustainability really does try to minimize the human impact on the environment, disaster resilience is trying to minimize and the environment's impact on our built environment. And I have a graphic here that really shows how disaster resilience is part of sustainability with economic vitality, quality of life, environmental quality, these other areas that sustainability has as goals and targets. Resilience needs to be there too. And one example is an earthquake-resistant building that is quickly reoccupiable, whether it's a business or a housing unit. It also provides quality of life for people who aren't displaced and can quickly go back home. It provides economic vitality because it keeps the businesses moving. It provides environmental quality if it's resilient because you're not bulldozing it and putting it in a landfill and having to reacquire new materials to build a new building. It's just this emphasis that resilience and sustainability really need to work together.
What slide are you on now?
I'm on slide, it's on tsunami life safety, so.
Thank you.
I'm two thinking, columns, big deal.
Right? Yeah. Thank you for the handout.
Thank you.
We've shown this before, but I want to tie this relationship between the number of residents that live in the tsunami inundation zone and the percentage of land that every one of these communities on this map have in the tsunami inundation zone. And that gets to this real issue around the relationship between high ground and low ground. A number of communities have so much of their property inside this zone that's going to be almost completely destroyed. And the whole point, one of the primary points that we're making for working with Resilience for the Coast is relocating these critical assets like schools, water treatment facilities, power facilities out of this zone, because you will not have it to rely on if it remains there. The next slide is a starting point here to just show one community in Japan that lost almost everything. But there's a shot right in the front here of a school that's built on a terrace above their main downtown area. And this terraced school became a lifeline for people to survive this event. There's an SOS sign for helicopters to come and rescue people. This school is built in an area that made it a shelter, and it can get back and going again because it's outside of the tsunami inundation zone. This is a view, the next slide is a view of the same city from another area, but it's emphasizing that this relationship between high ground and low ground is so critical for survival, and this is where capacity for response and recovery is going to come from, is high ground. If your emergency operations center, if your hospital, if your fire stations are down in the low-lying areas, they will serve no capacity after this event. The next slide just emphasizes in the same community, they had their police headquarters, they've got the hospital, multifamily housing. They lost so much of their ability to rely on this because it was inside the tsunami zone and it had to be abandoned. And so I have a number of very quick slides I'm going to push through, but they're just after looking at that, I just want you to really consider, here is Seaside, Oregon. Here's Depot Bay. This is Newport. This is Florence. This is Winchester Bay. This is Bandon. And this is Gold Beach, just going from north to south. These all are going to someday be tsunami destinations, just like Japan, just like Chile. And these communities are going to be reeling when this occurs. And even though we may have enough training and education to get people to evacuate and to get to high ground, the recovery that's going to have to take place is monumental. At the end of the coastal chapter, the next slide shows a couple of tables that we produced based on what was delivered to us from the services, from energy and transportation. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but it really just emphasizes the long-term duration of getting these services back online and delivered to the coast because of the isolation there will incur, because of the complete damage of many of the transportation systems and energy systems that have to be replaced, not just repaired. And so I'm going to turn this over here to Jay to talk a little bit about the coastal economy.
The intent about this is just to say, you know, what are the major factors for the coastal economy? And we're just touching base on three of them: tourism, ports, which include fishing and other port activities, and timber. And all of them are really dependent on very vulnerable infrastructure along the coast.
Could you state your name?
Jay Raskin. And just to focus on one of them, the tourism industry, this is data from Travel Oregon. Basically, it's about a $9 billion industry in Oregon, yet 25% of the tourist dollars are generated on the Oregon coast. So this is just pointing out that this impact of the tsunami is not just the coastal communities, it's basically a statewide impact as well. So the question that both of us are posing is, how do you create a resilient coastal economy? And we need to know, when we're kind of focusing on strategies that don't disrupt the current economy. So if we're trying to relocate things, basically we need to have things that still operate and make sense for what we have now, but we need to plan for the future at the same time. And while we're doing that, we should make it better. And there needs to be a discussion at the local level and with the state about, you know, what exactly is that? What are our goals and what makes sense? When you look at tourism, as we mentioned before, we first want to save lives. We want to take care of our visitors, but we also need to develop a system where our visitors are engaged in the communities that they're visiting so that they come back and help us rebuild.
So in getting into just a couple of slides around our recommendations, you know, we start back again with life safety. You know, we can always improve our education efforts along the coast. Currently, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries is about to finish its update on the tsunami inundation and evacuation maps for the entire coastline. And this is a huge step. I think we're probably leading edge in the country on the technology and the scope of this project. And there's going to be a lot of implementation involved around getting those plans adopted. But we need to also improve our evacuation efforts in terms of providing more hard structure for people to climb hills, to immediately turn around and look and know where they need to go. If you're on any number of Oregon beaches and you look back towards high ground, it's brush or it's a maze of streets. We do have signs, but they're not consistent. We need to think more methodically about consistently applying the messaging that we have in communities and building better access and strengthening the access for people who have mobility problems and in terms of shelters, immediate shelters people can go to. And then this issue that Jay brought up is we're going to have a lot of visitors who have lost everything if they're in a car or however they're traveling. Their resources are gone, and they're going to be also among the displaced that have to be provided shelter and care and relocated back to their homes after this event occurs. And we also are just recommending targets for resilience for the coast, and the number one is really relocation for critical assets and infrastructure. We know you can't move all these homes off the beach, and people don't want to live that far away. But if there's a key part of the infrastructure for there that they're going to have to rely on, relocation really needs to be the first discussion point. And vertical evacuation is something that's been discussed a lot in the last few years. There's a lot of research going on about design criteria and placement and siting. And so that's going to need to be something in the future for communities that may have a long way to go or members of the community that aren't able to mobilize that quickly. The ports, for example, are one aspect of this whole piece. They can't relocate. They're probably at ground zero for any aspect of the coastal economies and infrastructure. And so they have a really large stake in this conversation and into the future about whether we can minimize their risk and or have a much more comprehensive idea of how they're going to get back up on their feet. And then the transportation links from the valley to the coast and up and down the coast, trying to find better avenues to either harden what's in place or are there workarounds that can be done behind estuaries to provide alternative routes that are outside of the tsunami inundation areas too. I mentioned debris management. I've got a slide that I took when I was in Japan 2 years ago right after the event. We saw mountains. We saw mountain ranges of debris in every one of these communities, and some of them would say, if we look at our annual budget for managing debris, it's going to take us 100 years to get rid of all this stuff. And when I was just there 2 weeks ago, I saw a giant incinerator about the size of one of the wings of this building out on the coast just burning 24/7 every day to just get rid of material that they have. And so our plan on handling this to help the coast get back up on its feet and provide access is key also. I don't want to just simply talk about how bad everything is, though. At the end of our chapter, we do have a highlight on disaster resilience in action, and it's not a surprise that it's coming from schools. Lincoln County got a bond measure in for Waldport to relocate its high school way up behind the city on high ground. They used the first FEMA grant in the country for a tsunami acquisition to demolish their old high school and set aside that land as open space. Both the school districts or the school boards for Seaside and Cannon Beach are working right now on acquiring land and the means to get their schools both to high ground. This is to provide shelter, but also so that kids can go back to school, and it doesn't mean parents have to stay home and not go to their jobs or be impacted in having to provide that care. We want to highlight that there are groups out there that are doing this on their own, and we need to look at how they accomplished this and how they mustered the public and political will to make it happen. So the next few slides are something I'm bringing directly to you from my trip when I was in Japan 2 weeks ago. And it's to show you the kind of visioning that's going on for communities that were devastated by the tsunami. And I'm really specifying one community that you saw on the slides earlier, Minami-san Riku. There's a community of about 17,000 people. They lost about 5 or 6,000, I think. I'm just guessing on that. But they've had a hard time with losing so many assets of trying to get back on their feet again. And what you see in this slide is where their city fit before. It was located at the mouth of two rivers at the base of a mountain. And so the tsunami came in and just buried it under about 40 feet of water at the sea level area. And so in the future, what they're doing is they're moving their city. They're shifting it back onto terraces that they're acquiring into these hillsides. And they're keeping their port facilities, their fishing community, and kind of their industrial zone still down by the water, which has insurance capacity for loss and recovery. But they're moving their public and government offices and their tourism and housing areas back up away from the water, well above the tsunami zone. And they have a mandate from the national level to build 101,000-year tsunami preventative measures, not unlike our coastline, which faces distant tsunamis and our own local tsunamis. But here's a couple of pictures back-to-back. This is before the tsunami event, and the next one is after. And your handouts may be difficult to see, but this community was washed away. It's gone. And so what I'm happy to report is when I was there, we met with the people in the city hall for about an hour and a half, and they talked about their 5- and 10-year recovery plans. And a map like this for a community that's dealing with recovery is a huge discovery for communities like ours to see how a community tackles relocating in yellow. Maybe you can't see the yellow, but all the circles and areas way back are going to be residential areas. The public facilities are back. They're making a lot of green space down in the tsunami zones. But there's a lot of work that goes into agreeing on what this looks like. And there's a lot of conflict that happens after disasters occur if you haven't worked this out in the future of the disaster. And this last slide is really the vision that they have now for their future city and how it needs to have an ability to adapt and manage incoming tsunamis through a number of measures of how they've put infrastructure in and relocated this. But this kind of vision and the public process that gets there is exactly what we need to start having conversations about in Oregon, too, because you don't want to be making this up after the fact and trying to recover that. You can get ahead of the game by coming up with that strategy now.
So back earlier testimony, you talked about Seaside, and there was going to be, it says, long-anticipated bond measures support the effort. May of 2013, where's that at now?
Do you happen to know a little more about that since you're connected? I don't have a direct idea where it's at right now. I know that it's been something that's been ongoing.
I'm asking because it takes extreme amount of public education to get people to believe that something's actually going to happen. And I think if you live on the coast, you just would assume it's going to be a matter of time. But I just don't know how that effort went or how it's going.
Well,
I don't know if they've pushed back the bond issue or not. They've hired architectural design professionals and they're in the process of planning for the school. So Representative Boone
I think they are moving it up, or moving it back or whatever you want to say. It didn't happen in May 13, but it's on its way. And there is talk of, in Cannon Beach, starting a charter school and working with a Seaside district. They have offered to and agreed to staff the school if the parents and city find a place to put it. And they've identified a builder, and I think they have a piece of property they're looking at now. Just I don't know all the details of it.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think if you recall when the event in Bandon a year ago or 18 months ago happened, a bunch of people ran down to the beach and stood on the beach and watched.
I understand.
And they're from Bandon.
I'm trying to catch a wave. No, I understand. It's human behavior sometimes and mind-boggling. Any questions of the panel? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you sense a will by our local governments and communities? Your slides here suggest a clean canvas after the event. Is there a will now to begin planning to move that critical public infrastructure to higher ground after we have a clean canvas?
Well, I guess I would start with if schools are any measure of the value they place on protecting them and the students, to me, it's encouraging. I know there's been a number of efforts that Josh Bruce from the University of Oregon will speak to around having convened a workshop in Cannon Beach in 2006 on this concept, on having worked with four community or the four southern, central and southern coastal counties on recovery frameworks, on a resilience project that's going on right now. So I think in some degree, lessons like what are happening in Japan, not only for the damage, but for how planning like this can help minimize losses and form a better trajectory for what a community could look like, I'm optimistic that that conversation would be a positive one if we're able to approach it comprehensively, along with comprehensive plans, mitigation plans, a number of other things that are already in place. This should just fold into that and develop a framework for that conversation.
I'm suspecting that federal aid would be conditioned upon at least aid to federal governments for building infrastructure, that federal aid would be conditioned on moving those buildings to higher ground out of the tsunami zone.
That's a very good question. It's one of the points we've highlighted is there's kind of a carrot and stick approach to that with FEMA because it's mostly for floodplains, mm-hmm. and they don't want to reoccupy a site that you bought out. For us, we've thought we need to find a way to accommodate that buyout, but to not take away the tax base. If there's a way to put a lower risk, maybe a commercial property or something, and when you're removing housing or assisted living facilities or something like that, some way that the community at the coast isn't being penalized for trying to do the right thing to help them still maintain a tax base. So all of these kinds of discussions, I think, are key for us to frame, you know, how every community would approach this a little differently.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And just to add to that, that's probably one of the steepest hills to climb is getting FEMA to change that paradigm of acting after the fact and a recovery rather than, or you know, preventing it in the first place and doing the seismic upgrades and planning for it, you know, and having all those projects be jobs projects. Is, you know, we can look at them that way too, but they make them safe. They make the existing buildings safer. They'll make future buildings safe. And when they place them, they'll place them in a safer location. But FEMA has traditionally said we have to wait till there's damage before we can address it. We're trying to get them to look at the front end.
Sure. No, thanks for that. Anything else? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. We thank have you. Another group coming forward on critical buildings.
Yes, sir.
And again, we following them will be Department of Land Conservation and Development, and then University of Oregon Partnership for Disaster Resilience, American Red Cross, and Business Oregon. So lots of folks to pack into the day. I appreciate that. For critical buildings, we have about another 15 to 20 minutes or so. And gentlemen, if we can do that, we'd be heroes. I see you have about a 23-page PowerPoint maybe, but we'll see how we do.
Talk fast.
What is here?
Okay.
Can't wait.
All right. Thank you, Chairman Matthews and Chairman Boquist, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. My name is Trent Nagel, here with Ed Quisenberry. Together, we co-chaired the Critical Buildings Committee, which was Chapter 4 of this report. We're both consulting structural engineers, but we're here representing the Structural Engineers Association of Oregon, which we've done this work for on this committee, and we've both served that organization terms as president of that organization in the past several years. So today, we'll focus our recommendations, our discussion on the recommendations from the report. And I think you have a handout here, the recommendation section, which is out of the Oregon Resilience Plan. And so those, it kind of highlights the topics that we'll discuss. I'm going to give you in the slides here, have a brief overview of the buildings that we looked at, the critical infrastructure that we addressed. And then we'll talk about the recommendations, which are broken into two sections. First, those immediate actions, those things that we see are necessary to get the ball rolling with this effort, and then sustained actions, which are those that require continued effort and persistence to implement and to achieve results. So I will discuss the immediate actions, and then Ed will talk about the sustained actions. So if you have, I think you have copies of these slides in front of you. Our, the first slide, our group consisted of, it was about half consulting engineers that looked at these buildings, and then we had also included building officials, hospital administrators, educators, contractors, National Guard member, and even a freelance writer that all participated with this effort. So slide two, the critical buildings that we looked at included hospital facilities, approximately 60 around the state, police fire stations, emergency operations centers, K through 12 schools, emergency sheltering facilities, community retail and bank buildings, those kind of speaking to and considered part of the critical or critical for resilience because of people's need to have access to retail, to be able to get groceries, basic banking functions. And so those are important after an event. Single family residences, we did some assessment of those, very critical for people to have shelter, even if they don't have utilities and the gas may be off, the power may be off, and is likely to in many places. But those are critical for them to even be able to shelter in their homes. Unreinforced masonry and non-ductile buildings, what we classified as vulnerable buildings. These are the structures that are the most vulnerable during an earthquake and historically have formed the poorest. So those are part of it, and then critical government facilities.
Question. Now, is this statewide or just focusing in the tsunami area?
No, this is statewide.
Statewide.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So we looked at it, and we looked at it in different regions, a coastal region. There was a tsunami region, and I think, I don't know if we had a slide earlier, but the basic tenet or that we worked with the plan was considering a tsunami zone, a coastal zone, a zone in the valley, and then eastern Oregon. And so we looked at buildings, how would buildings perform on average in each of those sections of the state. The results on a brief overview of some of those results are on slide three, where you can see healthcare facilities, for instance, in the valley, anticipate it may be up to 18 months that some of those facilities may be offline. That's critical when you need it immediately after an event, not 18 mm-hmm. months later. On the coast, up to 3 years. Fire stations and police stations, 2 to 4 months in the valley, three years or more along the coast. Many of these are in the inundation zone, and so that's where that average really gets skewed. That doesn't mean every building is going to see that, but on average, that was what our assessment said. Schools, 18 months out, housing in the valley probably will fare a little better, and it may be a matter of days. On the coast, maybe a month or better before those, on average, are habitable. This probably underestimates what we would see in older houses, for instance, which have several vulnerabilities, and in some cases those might not be occupiable at all. But you get a wide range, and so we're speaking in averages here. So how to address some of this? Our recommendations, beginning on slide four, with immediate actions. The first recommendation that we saw as a committee was to establish a state resilience office, and that's essentially to have somebody or an office that is the lead for this, a quarterback, if you will, that can really take this effort, be an advocate for it, do the education, assist other state agencies, oversee research, champion the cause. And so we saw that as something critical for a 50-year plan to have. Slide five was to prioritize education, and I think that's been mentioned earlier, the need for public awareness, public relations, to get that word out and let people know. There's personal resilience and education in schools that can occur. There's education with contractors and the construction community in understanding these things. And then there's business and facility and property managers, and that was mentioned earlier, but a need for better education with them and how they manage their facilities and the things they can do to be resilient. On slide 6, complete inventory of buildings. We need a better inventory. Right now, we have some inventory that was completed in 2007 with the statewide structural needs assessment. This followed the FEMA 154 rapid screening of these of schools, hospitals, police, and fire stations were included in that, and those helped inform some of our assessment of these buildings. But they're not entirely complete. They haven't been updated since that time. There's been buildings that have been upgraded and aren't included in that. There's additional reviews that need to be done for some of the more critical ones, and then more complete reports for broader sectors of buildings. A lot of these buildings that are mentioned are not cataloged and have not been studied even initially yet. So slide 7 would be to include post-earthquake inspection in the emergency response, and I think that was touched on earlier as well, to have inspectors that can go out and look at buildings after an event and incorporate protocols and procedures in the emergency response plans to engage these inspections, and also to strengthen some of the Good Samaritan laws, which speaks to the liability question, so that whether it's professional engineers, other professional people that have been trained, ATC 20 certified, can go out and assess these buildings. Right now, there's still some ambiguity and some question marks with what that liability brings if you step forward to do some of that, but it's certainly needed. So with that, I'll let Ed continue with.
My name's Ed Questenberry, co-chair of the Critical Buildings Task Group. So sustained actions, ones that which need to start now and probably go throughout the duration of the 50-year implementation plan of the plan. First is prioritize and upgrade essential facilities. The brief matrix on slide 3, I think it was, that showed you the duration or the resiliency gap for hospitals is pretty significant in our state. And so we felt that was being critical to resiliency response after the earthquake, to shoot for having all hospitals upgraded within the next 15 years. There is existing legislation, I think it's ORS 400, that laid out a kind of a game plan for this, for hospitals to be upgraded by 2022. So we're pushing that out further. Not much has happened with that existing legislation, so we're trying to frame something realistic here. Upgrade URM and non-ductile buildings. The buildings that are historically performed very poorly and actually collapsed in past earthquakes. Many of these types of buildings exist on campuses of hospitals, and so we rank those within that. So the essential facilities that are URM or non-ductile concrete, have those upgraded in the next 20 years. The rest of them, they're in the different other market sectors, perhaps within the next 30 years. Emergency operations centers, police, fire stations within the next 30 years. And then another pretty significant component of damage during earthquakes is to the contents of buildings, not just the buildings themselves, but the ceilings and the bookshelves and everything inside the buildings that create hazards for people trying to get out of the buildings and become a hindrance to life safety and recovery. There should be a significant effort to upgrade those components as well as the buildings that house them. The next one, slide 9, fully fund the seismic retrofit of K-12 schools. There is an existing, as you probably know, an existing seismic rehabilitation grant program, but as we understand it, it's underfunded, but the state has bonding authority to fully fund that program, and we recommend that that happen. And also to perhaps ease the distribution of monies from that program, to maybe soften the requirements for school districts to get access to that money so they can take care of their schools. Prioritize the replacement of the worst structures. That's one way around it, is identify what the worst buildings are, and actually, instead of trying to spend money to upgrade them, maybe it makes better sense to just replace them wholesale. Require ASC 31 engineering assessments of all K-12 schools. Trent touched on that already, but that would help us better frame the problem and prioritize. Update the database of school seismic assessments. Update, the database. There are many assessments have been done on existing schools to date, but there is not really one central database that's fully updated with that information. So get that done. Slide number 10, encourage the upgrade of private sector buildings. So this is where these public-private partnerships may come into effect, expanding the passive trigger seismic strengthening program that exists in the code currently to maybe make it a little bit more onerous or quicker triggers for upgrading, mandatory upgrades to buildings. Accelerate the retirement or full upgrade of vulnerable buildings. Vulnerable buildings, again, being the URM or the unreinforced non-ductile concrete buildings. Improve the plan review and construction oversight process. That's, quite frankly, highly irregular throughout the state. Every jurisdiction is different. Some are more restrictive than others. And some uniformity to that whole process would, I think, lead to a better better control over the seismic resiliency of the building stock. Introduce a voluntary earthquake performance rating system similar to what we have for sustainability currently with the LEED process. This is a means of recognizing buildings that either have been upgraded or that are seismically resilient as an incentive for building owners to want to, maybe improve the lease rates of their buildings or attract people to come work in their buildings. Encouraging the upgrade of private sector buildings. Additionally, we could adopt incentives to encourage building to perform to higher performance standards than that are currently in the code. Code right now is life safety performance objective only, but perhaps we're suggesting that if an owner wants to have a building that would perform even better, maybe they get some tax credits or some incentives to do that, to make their building even more resilient. And then lastly, encouraging the seismic retrofit of existing residences. Again, that goes to the human resiliency part of the equation. People are not going to be able to go back to work or go inspect buildings after the earthquake or help out with the recovery if they have to be at home taking care of their own situation. We threw in a few slides. The next three or four slides are images of damage that was sustained during the Nisqually earthquake, which is not too far away from here. I think we even felt it here in the Portland metro, in the Valley, Willamette Valley area. But these are examples of what we could be facing here. These show the different building types that we have very commonly in our building stock. URM buildings, concrete tilt-up buildings, non-ductile concrete buildings, and then the last slide, 15, is of non-structural components of buildings. You can imagine it's pretty hard to get out of a building with bookshelves leaning over and books on the ground and ceilings laying on the floor. So with that, we wanted to close. Chairman Boquist, Chairman Matthews, and members of the committees, thank you for the opportunity to present the critical building recommendations of the Oregon Resilience Plan today. If our task group was to pick one recommendation that is the most critical to move this effort forward and achieve the goal of resilience, it would be to establish and fund a resiliency office that could provide the leadership necessary to meet these goals. This dedicated leadership will be essential to achieving the coordinated and sustained effort necessary to meet the 50-year resiliency goals outlined in the plan. and thank you, and we'll take any questions you might have.
Any questions?
I have one brief question, and Jay, you can't say anything, okay? Ed and Trent, you guys are from the private sector, like everybody up here. What do you think is really going to happen when you went through this whole thing? Ground starts shaking, goes to 9-0. What do you think is really going to happen?
Today? If it were to happen today?
Yeah.
It'd be chaos. Yeah, it'd be devastating. I've had the opportunity to visit earthquake damage zones before down in California, and it's highly disruptive and devastating, and it takes years to recover. I think what's going to happen is, if it happened today in our current state of preparedness, I think you'd see it would set Oregon back quite a few years. It would devastate our economy, our local economies, and we have a lot of businesses leaving.
Care to jump in?
No, I agree, and I think the pictures, and when you look at the damage that from other countries in the last even few years, we've seen good examples in Japan and Chile. We could talk about Haiti. You know, all of these. There's variations in billing codes and some of those things, and you can factor some of those in. But when you see the damage that's done, and the results of those buildings, it's huge. And I think with this plan, the different facets that were looked at, when you look at the communications that are down and the damage that's done there, transportation systems, the fuel systems, all of these things, the business group that presented and looked at the interdependencies of all of this, it really is chaos, and it sets us back a long ways. And the building stock is one aspect of that, and it's significant, the damage that we'd anticipate. One of the things with this event too that I'll mention is that a lot of people have probably been in an earthquake in California or other places, and in many times those are quakes that are intercrustal, and their duration may be 15 or 20 seconds. With this event, we're talking about not only a huge magnitude of shaking, but we're talking about up to 4 or 5 minutes of shaking potentially with it. And so, and that's something that isn't currently addressed in most the building code really doesn't address that sort of factor, is that duration that this goes on for. It's very significant, and we are not prepared in most cases. There are certainly bright spots, and there are buildings that are retrofitted. There are new modern construction that takes this stuff into account, but we have a lot of old buildings, and we've had very few earthquakes in this state that is, you know, maybe lulled us a bit into thinking it's not going to happen here.
And I think we're lagging behind. California is probably better prepared than we are. They've been dealing with more regular high-level earthquakes for a lot longer than we have, and so they have things in place like OSHPOD and DSA that oversee the design and construction of schools and hospitals and the essential facilities in throughout their state. And so those facilities are going to be much more resilient than those equivalent facilities here in our state. So we have our work cut out for us to get up to where California is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you being here today. Thank you so much. We'll move on to our Department of Land Conservation and Development, Carrie McLaren, and is it Laren Woolley?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for being here. We appreciate that. And thank you to everybody for keeping us on track on time. And I do appreciate the comment about the resilience and how overwhelming this entire subject can be. And if we don't have someone at the helm, we could be lost and left behind. But we'll figure out how we can get there and where we're heading exactly. Thanks for being here, and if you will, state your name for the record and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Matthews, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Carrie McLaren. I'm the Deputy Director at the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm really going to very shortly turn it over to these two gentlemen who are doing a lot of work in our local communities about steps that we're already taking to implement planning around the discussion that you're hearing today. I just really wanted to express our department's support. As all of you know, we have 19 statewide planning goals that sort of guide the work that we do, and Goal 7 is our natural hazards goal, and that goal is really in alignment with the work that we've been talking about. It's to protect people and property from natural hazards. So that's a guiding theme for our agency and the work that we do, providing mostly informational, so providing access for communities to risks that they may be confronting, not necessarily being the developer of that data, but really making sure that communities are aware of the latest data that is available to address hazards. And the other is with respect to technical assistance. So for us, that means the development of users' guides, model codes, and the development of risk evaluation methodologies so that communities are prepared to confront these hazards. We also work with communities in local communities, and we're fortunate on the coast to actually have two offices, one in Tillamook, which is part of the Regional Solutions Center, where we have a field representative, and then a second office in Newport, where we also have the South Coast field representative. Laren Woolley, sitting the farthest to my left, works there, as does Matt Spangler, our coastal specialist. So we're grateful here in this sense that we actually have people in the local communities who are working with the city and county governments to implement this work. With that, I'm going to turn it over, I think, first to Laren Woolley. He is our Coastal Shores Specialist. And then after that, Steve Lucker will talk about our floodplain and natural hazards mapping directly related to risk map. So thank you.
All right. I'll try to be brief and fast. Chair Matthews, Chair Boquist, members of the Senate and House Committee that are left. I really appreciate getting the opportunity to spend just a few minutes with you. Jay Wilson and Jay Raskin, I think, did a good job of talking about Chapter 3, Coastal Communities in the Oregon Resilience Plan. It addresses multiple things that communities should be thinking about and focusing on to become more resilient to a local tsunami. And by the way, you don't have to follow along if you don't want on the slides. They're pretty much testimony slides anyway, and without a lot of pictures, so we can just move right on through it. It doesn't impact me very much like it did the others. Some of these strategies that are in Chapter 3 of the plan are directly related to local land use planning. That's sort of where we come in with as the land use planning agency for the state. If I had to want to emphasize a particular message today from us, it's that we are committed to this effort. We have a sense of urgency about it. We participated in the Oregon Resilience Plan creation. We support it. And we certainly are committed to assisting local governments in their work and the great deal of work that they have to do, which really falls within, as Carrie said, our broad hazard planning efforts. Local governments, local communities have a variety of strategies, land use strategies that they could employ to increase their resilience to this type of catastrophic event. And just for context, I want to mention a few. They could adopt the Dagami tsunami inundation maps within their local comprehensive plans and assess the risks. They can develop comprehensive plan and code provisions to address their community resilient goals and policies. They can provide for relocating key community facilities such as schools and hospitals out of harm's way, like we've been talking about today. They can support integration of evacuation route planning within their local land use planning programs. And they can identify mitigation options for existing development to make them more resilient, and in general, they can encourage and support their community, their local community land use planning efforts in terms of addressing a tsunami event of this caliber. And I would say that here that we have clarified our DLCD policies on how we can assist local governments in their community planning efforts, and we're happy to assist them. We've had lots of communications with local governments on this topic, and there's certainly a desire to do it. So overall, to assist in this effort, and this is listed and talked about a bit, quite a bit in Chapter 3 of the Oregon Resilience Plan, the LCD is developing a user's guide or a toolkit, tools in the toolbox kind of a thing, to help communities tailor land use resilience measures to their needs. We're working in this effort, we're working with local government representatives and key state agencies as well. We're sort of in the middle of the process, and we've received some really good comments and some real positive feedback on where we're headed. The user's guide will focus on land use strategies that will try to do a couple of things. And we've talked, previous speakers have talked some about this, but getting people out of harm's way from a land use perspective. There's a large component of evacuation route and hardening planning and again hardening that could be placed within a comprehensive plan and implementing ordinances, and also encouraging another strategy, large strategy, is encouraging through incentives and regulations moving structures and facilities like hospitals and schools and things like that out of to high ground over time, and also providing mitigation options for uses which remain at some risk. User's guide will include draft model code, comprehensive plan provisions and policies, and also model code development code provisions that local governments can utilize quickly and easily how they see fit. And it'll include other land use strategy options like incentives and funding mechanisms and development standards and things like that. It'll also include links to additional assistance and resources. So where are we at in the process? Kind of in the middle. We anticipate that the user's guide will be done by the end of the year, this year, 2013. Once it's completed, we'll provide the user's guide to all coastal jurisdictions, and we'll provide outreach and education on the materials to anybody who'll listen to us. And we think that that'll be significant, and we'll assist in any interested jurisdictions, and we'll assist them in their work. You bet.
Chair Boquist and Chair Matthews and the committee, my name is Steve Lucker, and I am the floodplain and natural hazards mapping specialist for DLCD, and I'm also FEMA's risk map coordinator. And I just very briefly wanted to talk about a couple of projects that were involved in that we think will Oregon Resilience Plan will help bring to the community some needed information and tools. The first one is FEMA's risk map program. About 3 years ago, FEMA's floodplain mapping program had a makeover, and essentially it was going from FEMA as going to communities and dropping the maps off on their tables and saying, go do good work. The makeover is really what the acronym MAP is about in the risk map, and it's mapping, assessment, and planning. It's a recognition that the maps are only the beginning of the conversation. What's really important is what you do with the maps. And the vision for risk map, the initiative, is to deliver quality data that increases public awareness and leads to action that reduces risk to life and property. And that is a key phrase. It's not a throwaway phrase. It's leads to action that reduces risk to life and property. So through the risk map program, FEMA provides information to enhance local mitigation plans, improve community outreach, and increase local resilience. So there are three aspects to this program. It's no longer just floodplain mapping. It's engaging the community, and the community is the critical part of this. The first stage of a risk map program is FEMA visiting, talking with the community along with the contractor, and along the coast, it's DGAMI and DLCD, and talking about the hazards and risks, and discussing and documenting and putting together a package, what we call the discovery report. And it is somewhat like a hazard mitigation plan, but it's a complete documentation of the community's thoughts, data, and items like that. The second part that
is really critical to the process today that we're talking about is RiskMap considers all hazards. It's not just floodplain mapping anymore. It's an all-hazard approach, and that includes landslides, earthquake, tsunami. And that's a critical piece because FEMA recognizes, again, the importance of mitigation, and that's the third point that is a real takeaway from this project. The focus is on what the community can do to mitigate the natural hazards. Throughout the whole process of the risk map, the community is involved, and the final output is for the community a risk analysis report and tools and suggestions for mapping and perhaps some funding to accomplish some of these parts. I think you have a map that shows the projects that are involved, that we're involved in now throughout the state. There are about 13 of them, the entire coast. Again, Dagami, it's taking lead for the mapping portion of that. And then we have several others. That's about 75 communities that we've talked to now. We have yet to get to the risk analysis for any of these communities, but I think the important piece is that this is really a vehicle, a mechanism to take the Oregon Resilience Plan, incorporate it in the process that FEMA is going through. And then the last piece, which is important for those of us who work with these grants, is a synergy of programs. It's their risk analysis program. It's their mapping program. And it's their mitigation program. And previously, they've all been sort of their separate streams. And this is more of an effort now to bring those three branches together into a concerted effort. And so we're very pleased to see that. We're excited about bringing this project and folding it in at the community level. Because previously, they haven't had much to work with as far as tsunami and earthquake. Obviously, the tsunami maps are going to be fantastic. But there's still questions about the earthquake parts. The other piece that briefly also I want to talk about is our involvement with the State Hazard Mitigation Plan. DLCD is overseeing that plan. The current plan was accepted last year around, I think, springtime. And the current schedule is to have that plan updated by 2015. And we're in the early stages of that. We're working closely with the Oregon Department of Disaster Resilience and a group out of the University of Oregon called Infographics to develop a risk analysis aspect and revise how that's been done. The takeaway from this process is that the Oregon Resilience Plan, again, will be a significant resource in the development of that plan. And we're looking forward to pulling it all together. The other piece is that several groups involved in the making of that plan are also involved in the creation and the update of the hazard mitigation plan, the state hazard mitigation plan. So there should be some good continuity between those activities and those groups. So wanted to mention those two projects. It's still fairly early on, but I think should be very interesting for us.
And I have one last slide. This is Laren Woolley again with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I just wanted to briefly introduce one other related coastal project that we're involved in. It's called the Resilience Networks Pilot Project. Jeff Weaver of our agency is our lead in the project, and Josh Bruce, that's here to talk next, is a co-lead, and he may want to talk a bit more about that, and so I'll just be very brief. But we were able to obtain a substantial grant from NOAA to fund this pilot project in Clatsop County. The local community partners are Clatsop County, Cannon Beach, Seaside, and Gearhart. And I think they're excited about participating. And other partners, of course, are the Oregon Partnership for Disaster Resilience, Oregon Sea Grant, and, of course, our Oregon Coastal Management Program housed within our agency. The some of the substantial goals, at least, of this project are to help those communities plan for community resilience in a comprehensive way, to establish a community coastal community resilience network, and to comprehensively address multiple hazards, including tsunami, but others as well. I think that's it.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony today, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Next up, I think, making our way, Josh Bruce from University of Oregon Partnership for Disaster Resilience. We are close to being on time, just slightly over, but we'll see how we can do about getting this thing ironed out.
Catch us up a little bit.
Thanks very much, Josh. Good to see you today, and if you'll introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to discuss statewide resilience efforts in Oregon and to provide comments in support of the Oregon Resilience Plan. For the record, my name is Josh Bruce. I work at the University of Oregon. I currently direct the Oregon Partnership for Disaster Resilience, which is one of four programs within the Community Center Service Center at the University. Now in our 40th year, the Community Service Center links the energy, expertise, and innovation of the university with the planning and public policy needs of Oregon communities. To give you an idea of the scope of our work, last year we covered 34 of the 36 counties in the state with projects ranging from economic development and Main Street revitalization to parks planning and local food initiatives. Certainly our program focuses on natural hazards, and our service learning model provides opportunities for over 125 students a year to get real-world experience out in communities. I'm here to request that you consider two key issues related to the Oregon Resilience Plan. First, success of the Oregon Resilience Plan will ultimately be measured at the local level. Thus, in order for the plan to succeed, state-level investments must be matched by similar investments made at the local scale. Second, while the specter of a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake and the devastating tsunami that will follow it is the primary driver of the Oregon Resilience Plan, resilience is by definition a multi-objective, all-hazard, all-threat endeavor. Therefore, strategies to improve Oregon's resilience to earthquakes must consider potential impacts from other hazards and threats. To my first point, beginning in 2008, Oregon Partnership for Disaster Resilience worked with Curry, Coos, Douglas, and Lane counties to develop county-level disaster recovery plans. These were the first plans to be developed for the southern Oregon coast. To my knowledge, they might have been the first in the state and some of the first in the nation to be done pre-disaster. It goes without saying that for many, participation fell into the category of other duties as assigned, right? While local participants found the time to show up for meetings, they provided invaluable input and participation. When they left, most went back to jobs that did not include resilience or disaster recovery as part of their key functions or elements. More importantly, many local economic development professionals and business leaders chose not to participate. We heard things like emergency management deals with disasters, or disaster planning is outside economic development scope of work. In short, resilience and recovery planning is somebody else's job. We're going to try and keep the lights on tomorrow. Thank you very much. While our efforts on the South Coast are clearly documented in written plans, I'm not able to report to you that ownership or implementation of those plans has been achieved. And the reason for that, I believe, is that many communities in Oregon simply lack the capacity and the technical expertise at the local level needed to manage and support local resilience activities. In order for our great state to be resilient to threats like Cascadia, state-level investments must be matched by complementary investments made at the local level. To my second point, the Oregon Resilience Plan does effectively demonstrate the interconnectedness of our various infrastructure sectors and the extent to which our state's economy is reliant on the provision of basic services, food, water, energy, roads, all the things that folks before me have been talking about. Other speakers in prior hearings have also effectively demonstrated that there is a very clear business case to be made in support of the recommendations contained in this plan. That said, the Cascadia earthquake is not the only threat we face. True resilience requires the development of multi-objective strategies and solutions that address potential impacts from multiple threats. As an example, Oregon Partnership is currently working on the project that Laren mentioned. It's a coordinated project with Department of Land Conservation and Development and the Oregon Sea Grant Program working in Clatsop County. Communities in Clatsop County are most certainly at risk from earthquakes and tsunamis. That's pretty obvious, I think, to all of us. But they also contend with coastal erosion, winter storms, periodic flooding, wildfires, landslides, et cetera. So to develop resilient strategies that address any one of those hazards in isolation could overlook key vulnerabilities. Worse yet, money spent
on projects to mitigate those impacts could very well be wiped out by another hazard if they're not pretty carefully coordinated and considered. Our project in Clatsop County is aimed at developing multi-objective, multi-hazard resilience plans. These plans will address not only the Cascadia earthquake and tsunami threat, but threats resulting from future climate uncertainties and other non-geologic hazards. State-level resilience efforts should follow a similar model, I think, and resilience should be achieved when all hazards have been considered and the strategies developed to mitigate those risks achieve multiple objectives. So in summary, I'm simply here to ask that as you evaluate the plan and implement the recommendations contained therein, that you leverage state-level investments with resources to increase capacity at the local level. And I encourage you to view resilience in Oregon as a multi-hazard, multi-threat, multi-objective endeavor. So on behalf of the Community Service Center and the U of O, and certainly the Oregon Partnership for Disaster Resilience, we're happy to serve as one of many partners currently working on this issue in the state. And action on the recommendations contained in the Oregon Resilience Plan, I can tell you from working on this, it's an extremely important step in realizing that resilience vision. And I applaud all of your efforts and careful consideration of the issue. Happy to take questions that you have.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Any questions? And thanks for recognizing and having us recognize again, hazards are of all types. So thank you, John.
Cheers.
Have a great day. I won't say go Beavers, but they are playing baseball right now, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks again.
I feel that pain. Can I not go any place without one of these?
Somebody's got to mention it. All right. And if we could please have American Red Cross up next, Marie Wacker and Eric Corliss, please. And thank you. We have your presentation in the handout, so if you'd like to just state your name for the record.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, Chairs Boquist and Matthews and Vice Chair Anderson. We're pleased to be able to be here today. We wanted to start our presentation. First of all, my name is Marie Wacker. I'm the Regional Executive Chief Executive Officer for the American Red Cross in Oregon and Southwest Washington. And I have joining me today Eric Corliss, our Chief Operating Officer for the regional program as well. We wanted to take a moment to talk about the Oregon Resilience Plan and in particular the elements of it that we see most valuable. The State Resilience Office is a recommendation that we would welcome establishment of. We think that leadership on this topic in the state is desperately needed and that we would look forward to working as a partner with that office in educating and making sure our public and our communities, schools, neighborhoods, and businesses become more resilient. Additionally, as we would add that the Oregon Resilience Plan, while working and delivering on the built environment and making it better, it only strengthens the work we will do in educating the public and teaching them how to be prepared and the actions and activities they need to undertake. So a firm infrastructure and plans for all of those things really make the work we do rise to its optimum, actually. And then last, we believe that incentives that increase state policies, incentives that could increase citizen preparedness, school preparedness, business preparedness are really important to think about. And in particular, a K-12 curriculum that includes preparedness education and in an additionally life-saving training, because we know in this kind of an emergency, EMS will be overwhelmed, and having people all around know how to deliver basic first aid will be valuable to us at the time. We would encourage that the state think about local government employee preparedness. In our communities, local government is the first responder in many, many ways. If their employees aren't able to report because they're worried about their families, as you've heard from others, it's just not going to be able to do the job we expect local government to do, and the Red Cross can partner in helping those governments do that. We also would encourage you to think about incentives for small and medium businesses to prepare their COOP plans, to think about their individual employee preparedness and what you could do to really incent those businesses. We know our large businesses have the resources to do that. What we find is that our small and medium businesses do not. And as an example, though, this is a great kind of medium business story. We all know about the Pacific Seafood cannery fire in Astoria last week. Well, that is an example of a business who thought about continuity, and they really quickly were able to establish, you know, providing for ICE, setting up a separate business operations system. They had really thought forward, and they are able to already relocate their business by, I think it was June 15th that we were just looking at. So they really are a shining star in our minds for preparedness and what we'd like to see a lot of small and medium preparedness businesses do for preparedness. We know that the Small Business Administration has identified that 40% of businesses that are small do not recover and fail on after a catastrophic disaster. Additionally, that if they do survive, they also fail within, that 50% of them fail within 2 years because they can just never get over it. And then last kind of state policy that we think would be impactful is really thinking about assistance or incentives for vulnerable populations, not only vulnerable because of their geographic location, but because of their economic disparity, because of their housing, the kind of housing they're living in, and those kinds of things. Those are the folks that really we think about at the Red Cross because they are the most vulnerable. They don't have insurance. They don't have family networks. And essentially, they don't have the resources to really build and be prepared in advance. And we would really recognize, hope that the state could do something along those lines. And at this point, I'm going to have Eric talk a little bit.
Chairman Boquist, Chairman Matthews, wanted to take an opportunity to talk about some other disasters to really reinforce that. My name is Eric Corliss. I'm the Chief Operating Officer. Thank you. What we have done in other disasters, the Oregon Resilience Plan, as Josh said, is an all-hazards plan and will prepare us for it. The Pacific Seafood example of that business being prepared for any kind of disaster allowed it to recover from and be resilient from a fire that was unique to that business. That is critical for our survival, and we look forward. So I'm going to go back to some disasters that I have personally served on. Hurricane Katrina, when you look at that disaster and the scope of what it was, 740 miles of tropical force winds. And I was there for 2 months, and I responded to that disaster, and I was there with the people that were affected in Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And when somebody inferred that it wasn't a catastrophic disaster a little over a year ago, I was personally offended. But then when I started to think about the scope of that disaster and that the fact that we could drive to the Gulf Coast, and then you look at the facts that are presented in the Oregon Resilience Plan, I started to appreciate it. But then it brought forward the reality that we could be, this is my bad sense of humor from serving in the military, we could be the host of the first catastrophic disaster in the United States of America and its territories. That's a very sobering thought, and if nothing else, it drives us to have an extreme sense of urgency and what do we do. Also in Katrina, we saw the impacts of the vulnerable populations that weren't able to leave, vulnerable for the reasons that Marie already identified, but also because they just didn't have transportation. They didn't heed the warning and they didn't take it serious. It's our sense of urgency. We look at the Haiti earthquake and the impact that it had on Haiti and the lack of preparedness and the lack of investment and the suffering that it caused. And then we move over to Japan. And one of the things that really highlights there are two for me. Our president and CEO, Gail McGovern, was there 6 weeks after the tsunami and returned back through Portland and made a stop in our office, and we reviewed the earthquake scenario. One of the things that she really highlighted, and I'm sure we have heard it before, is that at least 300,000 lives were saved because they were trained, they were educated, they were prepared. That saved their lives. And you saw the impact, but one of the things that we did see, and I've heard engineers acknowledge it in this very building, that we didn't plan for the right disaster. And we bring that up because the earthquake that affected that region was much larger than what they were planning for. And to OSPAC and the Oregon Resilience Plan's credit, they are planning for the right disaster. And as was said earlier, by planning and preparing for this disaster, we'll be resilient for the storms that we know will blow in to the Oregon coast, to the fires that are burning, much like in Colorado right now that the Red Cross is responding to, but the fires that will burn across Oregon and the floods that will occur. We move over to Hurricane Sandy. I was there in New Jersey as the deputy director. what I saw firsthand was a significant disaster that knocked out power to 2.5 million homes, and the scope of need and that impact. And yet, even in all of that disaster and that 1,000 miles of impact from Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy, which is a bit dramatic for me, but that hurricane, very few roads were actually closed. And yet we saw the disruption to services, basic services, while the critical infrastructure was largely okay. But we still saw a lot of suffering there. And the impact of such a metropolitan area densely packed in that our plans weren't sufficient as a society, as a response community, to really bring aid to people in a timely manner. But what those communities did in many ways is they engaged their public employees in ways to serve. They didn't just hold out for firefighters, law enforcement, emergency management. Non-essential staff were involved in delivering services and providing emergency services. It's a change in philosophy, and it's in a change in a way that we engage our public employees and how we plan for disasters in the state of Oregon. That's critical to our success. And then Oklahoma, one final point I want to make here, is we all saw what was the highlights, the damage, but it was mostly the schools. And the critical nature that, yes, we need to invest in our schools, we need to improve that infrastructure, but equally importantly, we need to prepare our faculty and staff of how to make timely and smart decisions when bad things happen. That we saw on the news, the vigilant action of those teachers that saved children's lives because they brought them to a safe place. We need to do that for our faculty and staff to save our children's lives. A couple things that I want to highlight additionally as we look at the scope of the large-scale disasters. They're growing in magnitude. FEMA has said, you've heard it before, but reinforce and remind us all that every dollar invested in preparedness saves us four in response. And one of the things that we're seeing is we're seeing blazes all across the West is our risk for wildfires continues to grow. And our investment in resilience and planning and preparedness of the state of Oregon will help us with all other disasters. The other part is disasters do not discriminate. They affect every one of us when they impact our state. The other piece that we did a survey of Oregonians, and what we found is nearly 80% believe they were prepared. But when we drill down and ask them the critical questions, are you really prepared? Do you have a plan? Do you have a kit? Will you do the things that will save your life? It dropped down to 33%. So we have a high comfort level that doesn't really match reality.
I'd like to take a moment to tell you what the Red Cross is doing right now. We are embarking on a 5-year strategic initiative we call Prepare Oregon, which we believe will save thousands of lives in communities, businesses, and schools throughout Oregon and Southwest Washington. We have 4 goals for this project. Our first goal is to serve as a leader, provider, and convener for preparedness in bringing Oregon communities together to plan, resource, and execute full-scale resilience plans. Objectives include, in this first year, developing 300 community profiles to identify risks, vulnerabilities, demographics, community assets. In particular, we hear about Tillamook, for example, and how they plan to use their water trucks or their milk trucks for water during a response effort. And so those kinds of plans we are going to be working for in 50 communities across the state over the next several years to really assure that they pull together that full-scale plan. Our second goal is to reduce the impact of disasters by teaching basic preparedness skills. This year, our goal was to teach 25,000 individuals, and in the future, our plans are to teach 300,000 individuals every year basic disaster skills, and as well to provide additional training and seek resources that will provide for that CPR and first aid training. Our third goal is to increase the Oregon Red Cross's own capacity to respond in disasters by doing things like building additional partnerships, MOUs with local governments, faith-based organizations, providers of meals, and those sorts of things, recruiting volunteers that know how to assemble a response and for their own community, especially if they become isolated and we can't get to them. And we will and continue to gain new partners, preparedness supplies in advance for those, again, those communities that would be isolated. And the fourth goal is really to raise preparedness at the employee and customer level as a top-line issue in the business community. We have identified a program we're calling Industry Leaders in Preparedness for Business, and by sector, we will recruit different companies to lead their sector in best practices with their employees, with their customers, and then additionally to then share those practices with that small and medium business community that don't necessarily have those kinds of resources. And we will and have begun already recruiting a leadership cabinet of business CEOs to drive that program. No. Okay, and we just want to report quickly on our progress on all of those, which has been strong.
So we've completed the profiles. We're identifying the five initial communities we're doing the next year, working on an additional maybe up to 10 in the second year. This year so far, beginning July 1st of last, our fiscal year, which will end on June 30, we've reached a little over 25,000 Oregonians. And when I say reach, that means we actually sat down and had a discussion and did more of an education opportunity to talk about hazards and talk about steps to highlight what should they be doing. As you look at our increased capacity for the American Red Cross, we've established 8 new MOUs with county emergency management agencies. We're expanding our reach into the non-governmental organizations to work with the Red Cross. We have a new agreement there. We've placed 2 additional shelter trailers, raising our total inventory to 52, strategically placed across the state of Oregon. And this last year, we've deployed over 150 Red Cross responders to disasters to include the Colorado wildfires last summer, Hurricane Sandy, and the Oklahoma tornadoes, to name a few. And we're doing statewide training on sheltering.
And our fourth goal, progress, related to the fact that we have recruited our banking industry leader, and we are very close to recruiting our utility industry leader, and their roles with their customers and their employees will be very exciting, we think, in terms of getting their sectors prepared. We also have identified other sectors for work next year. And both those CEOs have agreed to sit and provide leadership to the business community on a cabinet for us. The last thing I would just mention to you, in kind of one of the unique ways Red Cross is going about educating the public, is I would encourage you to download the various apps we have. If you have a smartphone or an Android, we have an earthquake app, for example, and the app actually makes it very easy for you to go, okay, there's an earthquake going on right now. First of all, it'll alert you that it's happening because you've said, I want to watch this area of the country, and then it will tell you, oh, it's happening now, I click during, and this is what I do. Okay, right after, I click right after, and it tells me what to do. So the Red Cross is really leaning forward on developing very easily deployable, right in your hands, information for what you do during an event, but also what you do after or in order to prepare.
So if I'm in Oceanside, mm-hmm. I'm going to be at a wedding in September 7th.
Yes.
And the tsunami happens when I'm mm-hmm. there. I could have that app, and it would tell me exactly how to get out of Oceanside.
I don't know if it'll tell you exactly how to. It would say, "Go to high ground. Do not." It'll say, "Don't do this. Do that." Those kinds of things. Wait till the shaking stops. For example, if there's an accompanying earthquake, those are the kinds of things that it would instruct you.
But
to
I do have a white paper that we're ready to submit to our national organization to include evacuation maps for people that visit our coasts, as well as safe locations, because that's a piece that's missing.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
You definitely want to walk uphill in Oceanside.
I know.
The streets are long and narrow going either direction. You're not evacuating.
Right. That's it.
I do have one quick question. How big are your trailers? You mentioned 52 trailers.
Mm-hmm. So they have supplies to initiate a shelter for 100 people. They range anywhere from length. In the North Coast, they're 18 feet long. Some are as small as 14 feet. So we have a variety of size. They're not completely full top to bottom, but they have the basic supplies across the state to initiate care for 100 people.
Well, we certainly appreciate all the work you're doing. And it looks mm-hmm. like in the private sector, you're farther ahead than OEM at this point. So glad somebody is at this point. We appreciate it. Thank you very much for your testimony. Lynn, you're the last one. Business Oregon, tell us how we're going to pay for this now, right?
Mr. Chair and committee member.
Just for the record, the House is in floor session, and obviously something came up because the other chair had to go vote. So, but the Senate, of course, is on schedule, on time, and on budget.
Absolutely.
So we're here.
Mr. Chair and members of the Senate, the responsible Senate. My name is Linda Chesler. I'm with Business Oregon. I'm the director of the Infrastructure Finance Authority. I apologize for being here late or later in your session. I obviously missed a lot of good information, but our budget was in front of the Ways and Means Subcommittee. And so I'm pleased to report to you that both yesterday and today in our work sessions, Senate Bill 813, which transfers the seismic rehabilitation program to our department from the military department, has been endorsed and recommended for passage. I'm also pleased to report that that bill also maintains within our budget and the recommendations $15 million for rehabilitation grants for schools and $15 million for emergency services buildings. The disappointing factor related to that is the bond sale related to those monies is not scheduled until spring of 2015, but in the interim, we will go through the course of identifying potential projects, working up their priority, making selections, and be all ready to sign the contract the day we have bond proceeds and be ready to go. So, I mean, that's really the good news. I commend Senator Boqvist and his leadership on getting that bill drafted. We went through a couple of iterations, and I think we've precluded all the pitfalls that would have made it a disaster, one of those being that the program doesn't transfer to us until January of 14, thereby not transferring administration of the present funding to our department here during the school recess of the summer when all the construction is going on, so that we didn't have contractors having to find a new agency to submit their bill to. So I think it's going to play out well. The last of those eight projects are in progress right now and will be done by the end of the summer. And so we'll start with a clean program, a reinvigorated, I hope, advisory committee, make decisions, maybe a few program modifications from what we hear from the community and how well the program's worked to date, and move forward. Be glad to answer any questions.
Well, I only wish we're spending more money on bonding for this particular program, but we're moving forward at least in a little bit.
I agree.
Thank you very much, Lynn. And I think just for the record, so because I've heard it four or five times so far, is we did put a funding request in to get funding for a state resilience office. It is in the Ways and Means process. I suppose it's buried in the PERS taxation revenue package somewhere along that line. Hopefully we'll come forward with that. And then there has been some discussions in the same token with the new permanent director of the Office of Emergency Management, Dave Stuckey. So. And with that, Madam Vice Chair, and we have one more hearing of this next week that we'll be going through the next series of priorities. By default, the House is on the floor, and by rule default, they automatically close out themselves when I close out the public hearing. We appreciate everybody coming. And I think all of the documentation councils are up online, so if members of the public want to look at any of the presentations, even though we didn't see them on our deal here, I guess this is a sign. This is hearing room A, which is the revenue room, and the screen is blank at this moment, so that must mean something. And with that, Madam Vice Chair, we're done for the day.
Thank you.